sit in their gilded House and Senate seats funded by the NRA telling us nothing could have ever been done to prevent this. We call BS. They say that tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS. They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call BS.
This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. This is a special Tuesday morning version of our Monday morning wrap-up featuring Reason senior staffers. Matt Welch, who usually moderates, is on vacation. Matt, enjoy yourself. I am joined today by Catherine Manga Ward, the editor-in-chief of Reason's Journalism Division. Catherine, thanks for being here.
Howdy, Nick.
I'm also looking at Peter Suderman, who is the editor-in-chief, or managing editor, excuse me, of Reason.com. Peter, good to see you.
When you look into the abyss looks back. I feel like that's our relationship right now.
And that, I hope, is a reference to the horrible movie, The Abyss.
It was actually a reference to the Jim Carrey version of The Grinch.
Yeah, which is also bad, because he decided to do a Sean Connery accent. But we'll move on. Our fourth at this bridge table, and we're literally all in the same room at a card table, is Robbie Suave. Robbie, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
All right. So please, before you go any further, subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're going to be talking about the Florida shooting and various outcomes or possible outcomes from that. We're going to be talking about the Russia investigation. We're going to be talking about immigration. And we may even talk a little bit about Black Panther, although only a couple of us have seen what's a pretty excellent movie, actually. So we just heard at the very start of this show a clip from an angry student in Florida who was talking about calling BS on various aspects of past responses to mass shootings. Catherine, is this time different? Is the Parkland, Florida school shooting going to actually change policy?
I am always happy to hear the youths calling BS on politicians. It warms my little libertarian heart. But in this particular case, I think, you know, the renewed focus on who is taking NRA money is now, as it always is, a red herring. I don't think that NRA money is the source of why we find it so difficult to regulate guns in this country. We find it difficult to regulate guns in this country because of the Second Amendment, which is a very important part of our founding documents. And what's more, as Reason has written over and over and over, we find it difficult to regulate guns in this country because there are a heck of a lot of them. Yep. There are so many guns.
Yeah,
and
people typically say there's somewhere between 300 million and 330 million.
Yes. People like guns. Their guns. The vast majority, the vast majority of those guns are not used for bad things. This is a legitimate defense of private gun ownership and is always discounted in these type of emotional calls for control. Yeah.
Peter, do you think, though, I mean, there have been signs and there were indicators of this after the Las Vegas shooting, which involved a thing called a bump stock that helped make a semi-automatic weapon, you know, fire a bit faster, approximating a fully automatic weapon, that, you know, there might be a ban on that. Whether that's effective or not, it would actually be a change in a federal law. Do you think there is much reason to believe that things are actually going to change, that laws will change?
I think there's some reason to believe at this point that we will see some perhaps minor modifications. And so the bump stock ban, I think, is one possibility. Much more likely, though, is a bill that is co-sponsored by John Cornyn and Chris Murphy. Cornyn's a Republican, Murphy's a Democrat, called the Fix NICS Act, which Trump has also suggested that he supports. And basically, it provides new incentives for states to follow existing law in uploading relevant information about your criminal background to federal databases. This is also a bill that the NRA supports. And so when you have the president, the party that is in the majority in Congress, and Democrats and the NRA supporting a bill like this, I think it's something that at least has a good shot at getting passed. I won't go
do you think
so far
that's
as
a
to
good
predict
thing?
That it will.
Or, I mean, or how do we feel about that? Is that it, will that actually do anything? I mean, it is interesting that the Sutherland Springs shooting in Texas, also last fall at a church, It was perpetrated by a guy who had been convicted at least twice of domestic abuse while serving in the Air Force. It turned out that the military was not actually sending it the information it was supposed to the various government databases that would have barred him from making a legal gun purchase. So in that sense, you know, obviously, if we're going to have background checks, the military, like everybody should be feeding in. But do you think the Fix NICS law is either desirable or effective?
Well, I think it's usually a good thing to have that when you have a law on the books that says states are supposed to be uploading pertinent information, you should want them to be in compliance. You shouldn't want to have laws on the books that states are out of compliance with. And so a bill that makes it that gives them further incentives to be in compliance, I think, is probably a pretty reasonable step.
Do we believe that about illegal immigration or employer verification of legitimate workers?
It's much better to have either, if you're going to have states that are out of compliance, you should want to wipe the laws off the books, or you should want to bring the states into compliance. The situation where you have a law that is not that people don't comply with, or that governments don't comply with, is, I think, one that is just simply not desirable from a good government perspective or from a libertarian perspective, because it kind of sends the message that we pass laws for symbolic reasons, that we pass laws and they don't really have any force, or they have random arbitrary force, right? Sometimes we enforce them and we don't know when. And that's just
you can call on a law whenever you need to wrap somebody up. I'm going to bring Robbie in for a second because he had a great piece last week about the push to kind of militarize schools or turn them into from minimum security prisons to maybe moderate security prisons or something. But Catherine, I wanted to ask you, school shootings happen. They don't happen as often as people were saying. There was a widely circulated and fully debunked claim that there had been 18 school shootings just in this year alone. That was absolutely not true. But, you know, is it enough from a kind of libertarian perspective? Is it enough to say, look, school shootings are actually, or mass shootings are relatively rare? The larger context is that gun violence is going down exactly at the moment that more people can buy more guns and carry them in more circumstances. So that's really the story here. But I mean, is there a libertarian response to mass shootings, which is just that this is awful, but it's also going to always happen in a free society?
You know, I really struggle with this. And if you look at the Reason website over the last couple of days, virtually all of our responses to this round of debate about shootings are negative. Almost all of our headlines start with the word no. No, there haven't been 18 school shootings this year. No, gun violence restraining orders are not consistent with due process. No, an assault weapons ban won't stop mass shootings. And it's no, Trump did not make it easier for mentally ill people to buy guns.
I think there's one that's also, there is no solution to mass shootings,
right,
or school shootings.
And this is not satisfying. Like, I get why, when on one side you have a photogenic group of school kids who have just lost their best friends to violence who are saying, do something, that it's just not super satisfying to hear a bunch of libertarians or in general, people who are defenders of gun rights say, well, none of that stuff's going to work, so don't. Now, first of all, it's totally legitimate to say it won't work, don't do it, right? We do that in all kinds of other areas of life, and we don't do it in politics for structural reasons. At the same time, it is typically not something people respond to say this bad thing you are worried about is rare. And this is something that I wrote about a few issues back in the magazine. The same is true of kidnappings and other types of fears that parents have for their children, to say, you know what, your kid's almost certainly not going to get kidnapped or shot at school. Not reassuring to the kind of person who's already worried. So I think there is a very, very strong push to do something. I am sympathetic to people who find Reason's response and the libertarian response generally of, like, this isn't going to work, and anyway, it's not a big, bad problem, not satisfying. I always go back to Brian Doherty on this, which is to point out that there are lots of deaths that are attributable to guns that we could make policies that would minimize those deaths.
Such as
suicides, such as domestic violence related shootings, such as gang killings, right? Like there are a bunch of categories of guns, of gun deaths that we can probably make significant progress on with good policy, but so-called mass shootings or school shootings are not one of them.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, there's 30,000 and change, 33,000, 34,000, thereabout, homicide, gun homicides in a given year, and half of those are suicide, or two-thirds of those are
half
suicides.
Half of the homicides are suicides?
Well, I mean, it's, I guess, suicides, homicides, but it's murder, you know, so... So it is an interesting thing, and it's always curious that gun control people always cite the larger number, but then they rarely talk about how many of those are suicides. But Robbie, to bring you into this, you wrote a piece about, you know, one of the immediate calls that was supported by people on the right and the left was like, well, what we need to do is to get more cops in school or get more people with guns in schools, maybe teachers, maybe retired. Fox News was heavily pushing the idea that, you know, there are thousands of, you know, retired cops who can retire at 50 or 55 on a full pension, and FBI agents who are just basically hanging out. They should volunteer and like just stalk school walls.
For a second there, I thought you were saying we should put retired Fox News commentators guns in schools, and I would like to stand firmly against that.
Okay, although a number of them are looking for work, for sure. But I don't know that you want them around kids.
Nope. Yeah. I'm going to go with no.
So, but Robbie,
you'd have to install a lot of green rooms.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and the
craft teachers' lounges basically are, right?
Yeah. They're... So
quickly becoming an anti-teacher discussion.
Yeah, no, well, yeah. So how can we blame this on the teachers' unions? No, but Robbie, what's wrong with saying, you know what? Like, if you had, you know, more armed guards, it would make schools safer.
Well, we don't have much evidence that it would. I mean, this school actually did have a school resource officer. Now you could say, well, maybe it should have had four or five of them or a dozen of them. But there are more and more police officers in schools over the last 20 years. You know, if you go back to the 1970s, there are virtually no cops in schools. Now there's like in 40% of public high schools, there's a police officer.
Can we pause real quick and talk about the phrase school resource officer,
right?
Which makes me want to die every time. It's just
a police officer.
It's a euphemism,
yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
What's the origin of that phrase? It's just how the original legislation funding them
it
was
sounds
written?
Family friendlier, right? And the problem is we don't ever talk about the trade-offs, right? I mean, sure, maybe there might be positive safety ramifications for having cops in schools in some schools. That's possible. But we don't think about the civil liberties questions. We don't talk about the fact that now you have police officers handling disciplinary issues in schools. Now things that should have been resolved by a counselor or a teacher or a principal are being handled by the law enforcement agent inside the school. I've seen play yard scraps, you know, kids getting in trouble for using their phones, and these things are now handled by the police. They end up as serious criminal justice matters. Kids, you know, due process rights, their rights to, they don't know to talk to a lawyer before they answer the school resource officer's questions.
So, in other words, they're future members of the Trump administration.
right.
Well, and actually we, as a nation, got a little tutorial in juvenile justice yesterday, as if you were watching the early hearings in the kid who's accused of who pretty obviously did do the Parkland shooting. There was a bunch of questions about what they were going to do in terms of sealing his juvenile record, unsealing if there's any previous juvenile record. Like, this is another piece, I think, that people don't fully understand, is how the criminal justice system deals with crimes that are committed or involvement with the justice system before you're 18. People, I think, often have a vague idea that record gets wiped out. It sort of does, it sort of doesn't. And those records can be unsealed by judges. So this idea also that somehow what happens in high school, even if a police officer is involved, will stay there is not always the case.
So you're bringing up the, and I'm old enough to remember, in the 70s, it seemed like every other teen movie was about your permanent record.
The permanent record.
Yeah.
Although that's the record the school keep. It's never clear to me who's the keeper of the permanent record. Mine, of course, was spotless.
Yes, of course. We all must believe that. But yeah, so then what do you do, though? Do you have any, I wrote a piece last week. I had watched, or actually on Sunday, I guess, Greg Gutfeld of Fox News, you know, he gave a monologue where he said, look, you know, he's a strong Second Amendment guy. We don't, you know, not much is going to be gained by indiscriminately taking away guns, even if that's possible. But, you know, here are a couple of things. And one of the things he said was hardening soft targets, which is very much like, okay, well, let's make schools, you know, if there's a roving, you know, gang of, you know, Blackwater ops walking in the lunchroom, that's probably less likely that a guy's going to shoot it up. So, you know, if arming schools and if putting in more surveillance isn't going to work, you know, what else is there to do?
Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of good evidence that there's just these easy solutions. And if you just had this many cops, then it would be much safer. Even something like metal detectors, which probably to some people sound like a no-brainer. Let's just have more metal detectors. I've looked at kind of the studies on that. There is not good evidence that even putting metal detectors in school has contributed to safety. It might have contributed to the students feeling like they attend a prison rather than a school, and that's not a good thing. Like, these are really not good things. I mean, there's some, you know, some people have suggested in this case they had done so many drills in the school shooting. They'd done so many drills that, you know, when they had actually done a drill that day, so they just assumed it was another fake kind of thing because they've been almost over prepared. We have to just, you know, remember at the same time that schools are very safe. It goes back to what Catherine was saying. How do you further reduce something that is already extremely rare via public policy?
Right. And that's also true of not just of shootings, but of all sorts of violence at school and bullying and things like that. To the extent there are kind of discontinuous records because the way that this stuff is tracked changes. But since 2000, almost in every indicator, violence at school has been going down or has been trending down. But then you get back to that question of it's one thing to say, let's not worry about airplane crashes because statistically they're so small and they're tragedies. But
and Trump stopped that from happening.
Personally.
Yes, that's right. Yes,
he is commanding the power of heavier than air flight with the force of his will and his Twitter
account.
Well,
this is, I think this is to talk more about the kind of broad-based libertarian movement. You know, I think it's a real challenge because, you know, libertarians are often talked about as having, you know, we're kind of like walking supply and demand curves. We're, you know, we're metal. We're not human. We're General Grievous rather than Admiral Akbar in the Star Wars movies. I'm trying
but
to bring
General
Peter
Grievous
was drifting off.
Got a cold. He was, you know, he had he was sneezing. He basically had the flu. I guess he didn't get his.
He's a poorly kind of flu. I don't
shot.
Get how.
And so that gave him a sort of a human, you know, heart, like a heart,
yeah.
right?
No, like he was like the Grinch.
All related to him because
he had like that the beating Tin Man. Heart. He started as a person, and they had to turn him into a robot for never mind.
Well,
never
we mind. Are really case, leaning yeah. on you see this. We're so afraid to talk about like emotional intelligence that we're talking about Star Wars and. You know, that Judy Garland movie,
yeah.
that annoying one that's even more annoying than Meet Me in St. Louis. But why don't we, instead of talking going down that road, why don't we talk about immigration? We have heard one of the most novel proposals for immigration reform from an unlikely source, former and based on that interview, I would say current OxyContin abuser Rush Limbaugh. Has laid out an interesting case for immigration reform. And it's, you know, not a serious recommendation, but it's worth thinking about where he said, you know what, I'll give amnesty to anybody as long as they can't vote, illegal immigrants who are here for 15 to 20 years or 25.
15 to 25.
Yeah, 15 to 25. Okay, that's a good range. You know, that he's showing he's willing to work, he can negotiate. You know, Catherine, what do you think about that? And what does it say about the bizarre state of immigration conversation where our own Shika Dalmia wrote a very good piece about that, saying, you know what, Rush Limbaugh is more progressive than virtually any member of Capitol Hill, Republican or Democrat, on immigration reform.
I think it's interesting because it's Limbaugh being completely open about the fact that Republicans oppose amnesty or other types of immigration liberalization because they're scared about how those Mexicans gonna vote. And, you know, in some ways, I guess this is a way to split the baby, to split the anchor baby,
if you will. There you go again, being, you know, disregarding humanity in your libertarian hot take.
I want all the humans to come here. I want them to live here. I want them to work here and be productive. I love humans. But the Rush Limbaugh proposal is in many ways, it is a more realistic addressing of the underlying political dynamics of the immigration debate than I've heard almost anywhere else. This is also, by the way, what a guest worker program addresses. And that's something that Reason has written about in the past. The idea that if people want to come here and live here and work here, but we're scared of what they will do to the balance of our electoral pool.
Or our entitlement programs.
Like, there are solutions to that. Now, it's not my preferred solution. Again, I would like anybody who wants to live here to come here and become a full citizen quickly. But, I think it might be good to be a little more honest about the fact that this is just Republicans being scared that immigrants are going to vote for Democrats.
What about that idea of delinking? And this is, rattling around in the back of Rush Limbaugh's proposal. Like Captain Queeg and his marbles. Peter, I look at you when I make obscure film references. Do you know the Caine Mutiny court-martial?
I draw them out of people.
Captain Queeg, with where he's playing with his marbles again. In any case, the idea of delinking immigration or legal residency and citizenship is fascinating. And Catherine, as you were saying, most other countries take this for granted. But in America, it's the whole idea is that everybody who comes here wants to become not just a permanent resident, but a full-fledged citizen, which means they get to vote. Should we be thinking about delinking those things?
I have mixed feelings about it. I do think that in general, people should become citizens relatively quickly, and that I absolutely think we can never decouple citizenship and voting. It's not at all clear what Rush Limbaugh meant.
Although, by the way, early in the Republic, in the early years of the United States, that was not very
clear. That's true.
Clear.
And of course, we take voting rights from felons who remain citizens in many states. So there are places where there's some gray area, but in general, I think to be granted citizenship status as an immigrant should be to be granted voting rights. I think in terms of the overall utility, let them come in on whatever terms we can get Republicans to let them in. Now, Rush Limbaugh's proposal is not going to be seriously considered.
It's worth comparing Rush Limbaugh's proposal to the legislation that has been proposed to legalize Dreamers in Congress. And in most cases, the Dreamer legislation defers citizenship for 10 to 12 years already. So Rush's lower bound of 15 years is not too far from that. He wants to provide citizenship immediately. It's not really clear how you have a citizenship without voting rights for 15 years. But if you just did something like what we've already seen, which is legal status for 10 to 12 years and a path to citizenship in a roughly a decade or so, if you did something like that, it sounds like Rush Limbaugh likes the bipartisan bills that he has been opposing for a decade plus that are in Congress. It really sounds like there's an awful lot of kind of overlap there that they don't want to admit, because that would mean signing on to an amnesty or what. It's not even entirely clear why, if you extended out a Dreamer bill to a 15-year timeline rather than a 12-year bill, it would look a lot like what Rush Limbaugh is
saying.
And
he said the A word, right? He said amnesty. Like, he was perfectly willing to say, I accept amnesty under these terms, which is something that Republicans have typically
maybe what Rush Limbaugh
needs. They really
needs.
Hate that. They like tax amnesty, but then they hate like draft dodger amnesty or immigration amnesty.
That was Reddit shower thoughts from Nick Gillespie. Right, it was like, they like some of the amnesties.
I'm getting more and more confused just because, like, choice, or there are words that are in certain contexts, one side will like totally give a bear hug to, and then others are like, no, never. But
Robbie, you want amnesty for everything, right?
Oh, yeah.
All
oh,
the
yeah.
amnesties
for future crimes as well.
That's right. You should be.
No, that's the blank.
I'd like
real
to see that
amnesty,
as a sequel to Minority Report.
Like, I love
amnesty
report.
For future crimes rather than like we take it, we arrest you before you commit the crime. It's like we preemptively just say
we're going to commute your
sentence.
Can you like plea bargain in advance for future crimes?
Well, you could, but you actually could threaten
I'm going to do that unless you bargain my sentence down. Yeah, and we all agree, I won't do that, and I'll only get 6 months. This is a great science fiction story waiting to be written.
I think we may be living in it. Robbie, when it comes to immigration, you grew up in Michigan, right? Like the Detroit area. Yes. What, you know, how did people, like when you, where you grew up, were immigrants seen as this kind of like existential threat to the Republic? Or more specifically, because this is also what is deeply disturbing, and I think, Catherine, you were getting at this, about it, like the idea that the Republican Party is saying there is no goddamn way we will ever get anybody who identifies as an ethnic minority to vote for us ever again. So our only solution, it's not to change our policy or become more inclusive, it's to strip possible Democratic voters of, you know, of voting right. I mean, God, that's, I would be so embarrassed.
The
to be
lack
a Republican.
Of self-confidence is embarrassing.
Well, and it's totally unnecessary in some, I mean, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because, you know, if you treat these people like this, well, of course they're never going to vote for you. But it's not obvious to me. I mean, if you go back to before this kind of new phase of really hardline anti-immigration thinking on the right. Before that, I mean, I think a lot of immigrants might have been natural fits for the Republican Party, or immigrants who are religious, who are social conservatives, who are entrepreneurial, who want to come to America to participate in a free market system where you can escape poverty. It's, you know, a Republican Party that was offering that kind of pro-capitalistic, more libertarian vision, I think would have been appealing to immigrants. And
even,
they just totally
Arnold
ran that off.
Even Arnold Schwarzenegger is no longer a Republican. And that's what he used to, he said, oh, I came to America to be a capitalist.
Well, this is also, this was in Shika Dalmia's good piece for us about sort of two different Muslim communities in Michigan. And she describes a political dynamic in Dearborn pre-9/11, where a lot of that community voted for, we're trending dramatically Republican, and then, you know, 9/11
and Asian Americans, I mean, which is slightly different than immigrants, were until recently.
Careful there, Barry Weiss.
Yeah, that's true. No, by this, what I mean, American citizens of Asian descent were it was not clear that they were natural Democrats or anything. And if you go back even to the 2000 election, you see a very different, you know, when you track ethnic votes, you know, it's a lot more even. I mean, that was an incredibly even
plus
election.
There was that minute when Jeb was going to get all the Hispanic votes.
Well,
right?
Bush in 2004, depending, there's some lack of clarity about exit poll results, but he pulled somewhere between.
He 40, said in the understatement of the 21st century.
Well, this one was particularly, but Bush got somewhere between 40-45% of the Hispanic vote. And when he was governor of Texas, he routinely got that. And so did Rick. And I realize the only thing I remember about him is that he couldn't remember three things.
Perry.
Rick Perry also did very well. John Kasich getting reelected in Ohio pulled massive. I mean, he won in such a landslide. He had majorities of almost every ethnic group. So this idea, I mean, it is bizarre that the Republicans are like, well, the one thing we can't do is do anything that would allow us to become likable to immigrants.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't remember this growing up. I don't remember the Republicans that I knew when I was growing up. I don't remember that being a big issue. I first noticed it, actually, I think, when the Tea Party was kind of coming into formulation, that there were these kinds of very passionate people who were both passionate about the sort of Tea Party ideas and then also had these really inconsistent, to my mind, views about immigration. I was like, huh, that's a little weird. And that then became like the dominant thing.
It's not just weird and it's not just embarrassing. It's gross and it's unseemly. And it leads us to a kind of really horrible and destructive politics in which you basically have one party that is women and minorities and another party that is angry white men. And that's, of course, an oversimplification, but it's not just that Republicans are allowing that to happen. It's that they are pulling politics in that direction by being so hostile to immigrants and to immigration. And so what they are doing is contributing to a more destructive and more polarized electorate,
through their sort of political orientation. And I think it's really bad for the nation. It's not just bad for the political party. It's bad for the country and bad for our discourse and bad for the way we relate to each other.
The original sin of that, too, may have been, or the original instance, I was living in California in the mid-90s when Prop 187 was pushed, which would have banned all forms of welfare for illegal immigrants and some recent immigrants. But it was clearly a kind of marker of broad-based feeling, particularly in Southern California, that the Reconquista was happening, the brownification of California. And what's interesting about it, Arianna Huffington at the time, who was married to Michael Huffington, a Republican congressman, backed it. Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, Democratic senators, were kind of in favor of it. But it was Pete Wilson, who was running for re-election as the Republican governor of California, really staked his claim to that. And he got a lot of Democrats to vote for him because white people in California, this was like their last stand. They were the Ferdinand and Isabella of California kicking out the Moors, except they were whites kicking out Mexicans who are descended from Ferdinand and Isabella, I suppose.
Well, if you look now, I mean, it is pretty interesting that the hotbeds of anti-immigrant sentiment tend to be parts of the country that are very white.
Yeah,
Have a lot of experience with
Iowa.
Immigrants, right?
Iowa, the Dakotas,
etc. It's sort of the middle of the country where the immigrants haven't quite gotten to yet.
And Donald Trump. This is the thing that I don't understand a lot about Donald Trump, and I kind of like the idea that he is just a random assortment of beliefs that don't fit easily into a traditional Republican or Democratic mind. But a guy from Queens, which is Queens, New York, is like the most ethnically diverse parish or district in America. You know, there are more voices, more language spoken in Queens public schools, supposedly, than anywhere else. And he works with immigrants. He hires immigrants.
Yeah, but he was also
like
an immigrant slumlord, right? I mean, like,
yeah, but you would think, why would he want them to stop coming?
Their money's green too, man. Now, yeah. I mean, I think Peter's right about the poisonous politics that come out of this, but I also think there is a sort of a corollary to that, which is the poisonous internal politics of the Democratic Party, in which you get a bifurcated party where there are elites, they are the sort of, you know, white coastal elites. And then there are the votes they're taking for granted, which is, all, you know, virtually all minorities, many women. And so you get sort of these smug is the word of choice, right? But these like smug white coastal elites telling all the rest of the white people in America that they don't properly understand their own interests, while simultaneously, in many cases, disregarding or misunderstanding the interests of the rest of their own party because they are focused on something else. And I think, you know, there's that internal dynamic we haven't even had a chance to see play out, because right now the sort of top line party of white people, party of everybody else dynamic is so consuming.
But then you hear among certain, like, and the Bernie Sanders people were kind of like this, and certainly not necessarily Democrats, but people further on the not the progressive left, but the hard left, like the socialist left, like our friends at Jacobin Magazine, Catherine. You know, one of the things they complain about is class has completely disappeared from left-wing politics because it's all about this ethnic identity, kind of in a response to the Republicans saying, you know what, we hate all you people who aren't white, like Antonin Scalia was white or something. You know, it's just bizarre. You know, Justin Amash, who is pretty good on immigration, but is like, you know, a Middle Eastern guy from Michigan, which is filled with Middle Easterners who are white Americans, blah, blah, you know. But do we need more class conflict in American politics?
I'm a little bit skeptical about the causal claims there. Like, you know, okay, we've stopped talking about class, and by we mean the left has stopped talking about class. And the reason the left has stopped talking about class is because actually you only have power in wielding class rhetoric if you have the working class on your side, right? Like, you get moral rectitude when you're talking about class if you're like, the guy who works in the bottle cap factory is my guy. And if when you don't have that anymore, which the Democratic Party doesn't, then all of a sudden it's like, let's talk about race instead, or let's talk about poverty instead.
Of course, that's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing, though,
sure.
Right? Because
then
they lose people if they're not talking about it. And so it's, you know, did they stop talking about working class issues first, or did they?
And Obama had if we buy, and we're going to talk about the Russia investigation next, because, you know, regardless, we can talk about American politics all day, but we know that the Kremlin is dictating everything we do. But one of the fascinating things is that a lot of the white working class areas that people are saying gave the election to Trump, and there's some reason to believe that in the post-industrial Midwest, those were places that voted for Obama twice, and then they flipped to Trump because Trump seemed to be talking, at least talking about class, of saying, like, you guys are getting screwed, your jobs have disappeared, I'm going to bring them back.
Yeah. I mean, he was a man of their culture as well. I mean,
even though he's a fucking billionaire who was only given $1 million loan, I guarantee it was more than $1 million, and it wasn't a loan to start.
But
his
he's a
business.
Reality TV yeah. star, and that's yeah. how he's an entertainment figure and one they watch.
He's been in their living rooms.
Yes, yeah. I think sort of elitist millennial types in their highbrow television consuming habits understand. Well, yeah. I have highbrow television consuming habits and like junk reality TV.
Do you watch TV or do you watch streams? And by that, I just mean like when do you watch any shows that are broadcast over the air?
Yeah. I mean, I have a cable subscription. Yeah.
But cable is different. Like, are you watching FX Network or are you watching ABC? Whatever must see TV
show.
Or
yeah.
you know
I,
the
Robbie
Full
watches
House.
The Bachelor.
I watched I watched Survivor. Okay. I've applied to be on it six times.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Ever get anywhere?
I got a call back once. I'm this is all this but, my job here is just an attempt to become famous enough to be
will
worthy
you
of being
do,
on the show.
Please do Naked and Afraid. I think that would help the libertarian movement.
Hashtag yeah. me too, Nick.
Maybe
have you watched Naked and Afraid?
I assume they're naked, so that's pretty much all.
And you know,
I'm terrified.
How does their hair look on the show?
It's interesting because they get dropped in the middle of nowhere, and it's two people, a man and a woman. They're naked. They're afraid because they only have like spears, and they have to hunt crickets. To
Wait,
eat.
They have spears?
Yeah, they give them like a small packet of
spears.
Of implements, you know, and stuff, and so. What's amazing is that sometimes their hair looks great, even though they've been out in the woods for like 2.5 weeks or something. Other times it goes to shit right away. But I think you'll be okay unless that coif is all product.
Yeah. It's all product.
I mean, mine is genetics.
Let's not give away the secrets on the show here.
Well. To bring this back a little bit to the class versus the class question.
Sure. If you must.
I must actually. No, I think there was a really interesting piece published by Luigi Zingales right after Trump got elected. And what Zingales, who is a scholar at the University of Chicago, has studied kind of demagogues in Western politics.
He's born and raised in Italy, and he's a classic guy who is pro-market, but he hates business because business in the Italian political economy is Silvio Berlusconi.
He
no,
is
I mean, it's
especially
all cronyism.
Sensitive yeah. to crony capitalism and the ways that it undermines actually confidence in the market economy. But what he's always said was that folks like this are best defeated when you basically say that they have failed on their own metrics, that they are not providing the benefits for you and your family that you thought they were. Don't treat Donald Trump if you oppose him. Don't treat him like some sort of crazed out of touch maniac who is like, you know, just sort of an insane person, even if that's what you think of him. Instead, treat him as like a normal president who is failing to deliver.
But he isn't, right? He's got unemployment. Planes are no longer falling from the skies. Catherine, I think you pointed out that like he's about to claim that all the gold medals that we may or may not have won in the failing Winter Olympics is because of him.
I definitely should have put an actual Brian Kaplan style bet on this that at some point in the next week, Donald Trump will tweet in some way that implies that he deserves credit for whatever golds we picked up.
The stock market's a little more volatile than it was a month or two ago.
True.
And, you know, these things they can change over the next couple of years, right?
The tax cut is popular now?
In some ways, I think Donald Trump is doing reasonably well on economic performance measures, perhaps in spite of himself.
And that is going to present something of a challenge to his critics. And I think that that's one of the reasons why people who don't like Donald Trump are in some ways they're, you see them both being kind of anxiously frustrated as well as kind of divided about how to go about opposing him because they fundamentally believe that he is a maniac who is unfit to be president. I'm not even entirely sure I disagree, but that's not the best way if you want to oppose him politically and get him voted out.
Which, that doesn't which seem brings us to the Russia investigation and whatnot, because that's one of the ways that it seems that his opponents, including many in the, you know, kind of in the conservative movement, are saying, well, Trump colluded with Russia. And that's, you know, that is what is very important. And we're going to get rid of him. You know, you watch over the air TV, Robbie, you watch cable TV, you have a Netflix subscription. I assume you're stealing somebody's HBO Go subscription so you can watch Real Time with Bill Maher. What?
I just can't admit that on the radio.
I understand. Yes. You know, what do you make of the Russia investigation and the idea that we are about to peel back, you know, this incredible vast machinery of a country that could not produce enough blue jeans or rock music to keep its empire, you know, just 25, 30 years ago from going down the shitter, is somehow able to have flipped an American, you know, election by a bunch of really clever Facebook ads.
This has seemed to me from the beginning as the very worst way to oppose Trump or to fight the Trump administration. The media loves the Russia investigation story. I watch MSNBC every night. Their coverage is like 99% this. I have never talked to a real American who cares about this at all. They want to know if the Trump policies are going to make their lives better, more economically.
A very quick sidebar here. Do any of us know any real Americans? And I say that as somebody who lives halftime in Oxford, Ohio, and I shop at Walmart almost daily when I'm out there, but I don't know what a real
American
could you
possibly need daily at Walmart.
Oh, it's
he goes to the conversation.
It's the experience and the greeters.
Wow. I assume that most of them are holograms and not real in the sense of that I'm real.
I mean, if we are all living in a simulation, what are real Americans anyway? Is that your position?
I mean, real Americans is obviously a semi-ironic way of talking about them. But people back in, you know, the Midwest where I'm from, friends, family.
People who are not in politics or
and
media.
In an elite coastal city. Yeah. Right. And they don't care. And I think they're right to not care, honestly. Mm. There's wrongdoing. Maybe there's obstruction of justice, right? The second order crime. But the first order crime, I don't think is going to stand the test of time particularly well. It's going to seem like another Red Scare type thing.
Almost
literally.
First is tragedy, then is farce, right?
Right. And then, but now.
Then they fight you, then you win? Is that how it goes?
I think we're mixing up a lot of
something. We're all going to be wearing Gandhi sarongs pretty soon.
I think you just made the motion for the ammo belt that Chewbacca wears.
That was definitely Gandhi sarong, for the record. You just see Chewbacca belts everywhere.
General Grievous.
I would have been interesting. Was there a nonviolent resistance group in the Star Wars universe?
I miss Matt.
Yeah, so do I. You know, no one more
Too
than
bad
me.
He's in Russia.
Yeah, he's getting deprogrammed. He's becoming Red Sparrow.
Oh, he is.
He's
going
to be. He's going to be the first male Red Sparrow. But do you worry about not about the Russia investigation per se, Peter, but what it finds out? Like, is there something that the Russia investigation could uncover that would shake your core beliefs in the American experiment?
Nothing would shake my core belief in the American experiment, except maybe if there was a video uncovered of Trump improbably speaking Russian to his handlers like Kevin Costner in No Way Out. I mean, right? It's like that, yes, but that's not what they're going to discover at all. What they're going to discover is that Trump exercised enormously bad judgment in his personnel choices and surrounded himself with really shady characters, some of whom had illicit dealings either in this country or sort of with the Russian government, business world, something or other. There will be some sort of financial connection there. And that doesn't shake my faith in America. That is just my expectation. My faith has already been shaken by the election of Donald Trump and by the people he has chosen to surround himself
See,
with.
This for
I thought you were going to say... If you find a video of George Washington speaking Russian, yeah.
Well, no, he spoke German. If you're at an Illuminati,
found
fan.
The video of George Washington doing anything, I would be
you would have
very
a lot of
surprised.
Questions, a lot of questions, yeah.
And I would just
how about
wonder,
like a flip book, maybe
the simulation. I would wonder what kind of glitch I had encountered.
What you know is there. Anything that Russia, I mean, like, why are, Catherine, you know, Peter said, you know, the fact that Trump got elected. To me, the fact that Trump got elected is less interesting than the fact that the Democratic Party at a moment when, you know, it lost a walkover election and Hillary Clinton lost a walkover election because she ran an incredibly bad campaign. And I feel like in a certain level, the media is complicit in just, you know, trying to make sure that we don't talk about how awful Hillary Clinton was as a candidate.
I mean, the media broadly has really covered that topic quite thoroughly. I'm not sure that I buy that as an analysis here. Like, first of all, we have an entire channel basically devoted to talking about what a bad candidate Hillary Clinton was, even as apparently we also have an entire channel devoted to the Russia investigation, right? So we've got our bases covered.
We should have another channel.
Yeah,
that's my theory.
That's a good idea. But then the other cable news channel just is devoted to countdown clocks. So I don't know.
Yeah. And that... do we actually want more cable news? I mean, at this point, there's a reason.
No, I just
why
said another channel. I didn't yeah. say it oh. should be a news channel. I was thinking yeah. more like the
Animation?
All comic books and science fiction.
Yeah, we have those okay. too. So yeah. Or, yeah, I mean, more generally, I guess I am not in the mood to sort of say, oh, well, the real source of badness here is the low quality of Hillary Clinton as a candidate or whatever. I also don't think the election of Donald Trump is a sign that like the American experiment is corrupt or that the American people don't deserve democracy or something like that. I think we'll know at the end of the Trump administration how good America is. Because if we're still basically intact and more or less as we are now, like A+ America, you win. Like if we can weather that, I will be impressed with us. And I think there's a chance we can, right? Like this is as we move through, we're now over a quarter of the way through Trump's first and hopefully only term, and we're fine. We're basically fine.
So when we elect Kamala Harris president, we'll know?
Yes.
Oh, that's true. It can always
why,
get worse.
Peter, why are you trying to make me cry? Right. So, you know, I candidates are bad. Politicians are bad. Bad politicians win. All of those things are built into the system. The system
well,
can deal with
but
that.
But here, I mean, Robbie, do you think, is Trump categorically worse than Obama? And by that, what I mean is, you know, obviously he's unpresentable. He's uncouth. He's actually funny, I think, in a substantial way that rarely gets appreciated by people, especially if you're not from the New York area. But is he actually worse than Obama?
He is in terms of temperament and attitude.
Who cares? Right. Like in a way, you know, forget about it. You know,
yeah.
Like,
but what, no, this for the his first year, his policies, I think, have not been anywhere near as bad as his harshest critics expected. The problem is and young people really dislike him because he sort of makes a mockery of the entire government. It's embarrassing for him to be president.
Which is lame, but young people should like mockery.
Yeah.
They should be into
Well, so that might be a good sort of outcome of this, is people sort of losing faith in, or they should realize that just because you have a democracy doesn't mean you can have this all-powerful government, right? Just because we make decisions democratically.
How do we sell that? We've been selling that since Watergate.
I have an idea. Let's put democracy in chains. Nancy McLean can help. But this is, I mean, actually the student response and the response to the student response to the Parkland shooting suggest the opposite, right? That actually maybe we have a sincerity deficit and that like the youths are going to step up and fill it. And help us do the things to make America better or something.
Wait,
finally, so, somebody cares about the deficit.
Yeah.
Not the
no,
deficit.
But wait, I mean, so you're saying like there's a new earnestness.
Yeah, people have responded strongly to this sort of very sincere, earnest, you know, kid at the microphone just saying what they feel is right. And arguably that is the reason people are so receptive to that is because what they're hearing on cable chatter shows or whatever is just like pure wall-to-wall.
Although
cynicism.
Trump is also going to meet with students, right? Survivor students, I think.
He went down there and then went to his golf courses. I think the earnestness versus ironic sensibility is the true dividing line between the kind of Gen X and millennial worldview. And this is why, right, like there's always some confusion about exactly what the dividing line is. The dividing line isn't a year. It's whether or not you're sort of fundamentally earnest in your approach to the world and your expectations, or whether you're just sort of like, eh.
So Gen Z is earnest and millennials are
no.
Men,
millennial,
what you're
the
saying?
Gen X is
oh Gen
ironic,
X.
Right?
Oh.
Moved on.
Nobody's talking about Gen. We're done.
The slacker generation is
which, by the way, I'll point out started out as a look. As a late okay. baby boomer thing. But yeah, no, there was a high watermark of irony, which the editor of Vanity Fair, Graydon Carter, said died. Who had been the co-founder of Spy said died on 9/11. I think he was wrong about that. But yeah, irony as a modus vivendi seems to be
but
dying.
these kids who are part of this movement are actually not sort of not millennials. They're like in the transition to the
Z.
next thing. Yeah, they're Gen Z.
But,
so
well,
we're still trying to figure out what the what the cultural identity
but
of
millennials
Gen Z is
going are
even
earnest,
more
right?
Earnest.
Millennials are woke, like you can't make jokes, you can't
yes.
you know, like they're
yes.
very
but Gen Z might revolt against
oh,
that the
I
same way that millennials
yeah,
yeah revolted against For, Gen X is not caring.
I have two sons, one is 24 and one is 16, 23 and 16. I don't know. You know, I can pick them out of a lineup. I can't name their exact ages right now. But no, but the older one, who's very much of a millennial, is more earnest. I mean, he has a sense of humor and he loves South Park and all of that kind of stuff. But the younger,
perfectly
he's more
good
woke.
Gold standard for does he have a sense of humor there, yeah. by the way? Like yeah. South Park, good,
but,
bad,
but it's
done.
But he's woke in a way that my younger son, who's Gen Z, where the things that my older son encountered late in high school or in college are now being encountered in middle school, and it is being kind of crammed down people's throats. And they seem to be much more sardonic, actually, than millennials.
Yeah.
Which confuses this conversation because the people at the high school are actually Gen Z, not millennials.
Yeah.
And they're very, yeah. but
I mean, if you're going to have a moment for overwrought sincerity,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
fair to
oh,
be like the
absolutely.
Moment right after your
yeah,
school
no,
got
absolutely.
Shot up.
Well,
absolutely.
And interesting,
yeah.
all, you know, these kids are also super, super, not to sort of go back to this conversation, but health, mental health interested. The language of trauma. Is gotten more and more and more popular, is talked about more openly on college campuses in K through 12. It's very normal to discuss mental health and
how that
plays into this.
Do we think that has something to do with social media, which really sort of encourages a kind of openness and sharing about these things, and not just an openness in your terms of yourself, but an exposure to a lot of it? You see, just as a result of being on social media all the time, you're kind of exposed to the interior of people's minds and their inner lives in a way that just you weren't.
You're not 20
alone. Or 30 years
you're
ago.
Not alone.
But
in
this
your
is
suffering.
Isn't that a sort of I mean, you know, the Prozac generation, right? Like it's sort of a misreading to say that this generation is discovering sort of fellow skeptic.
I didn't say they
health.
Discovered it, but they are more concerned about it, more vocal about it. They
and
seem to
more
be
visible.
More focused
you
on
seem,
it than yeah. than even the Prozac generation. But the Prozac generation also had more relative to the previous generation, more kind of exposure to the inner lives of others
well,
and to their
is,
own
if I can
like
speak
issues.
As an ambassador from the you know 19th century or something, it still amazes me. You know, so I'm 54. I know a lot of people my age who. If you said, well, why don't you go see a therapist? They would be like, what? Am I like fucking nuts? You know, et cetera. I take for granted, and I think everybody younger than me takes for granted the idea that seeing a counselor is not a bad thing. It's like something you do, like you go to the gym or you.
It's as natural as taking
get
vitamins.
Your oil changed.
Yeah. And that pharmaceutical shift, yeah. too, of like, going from Prozac Nation could be a big thing because it was relatively new, but you know, the idea of SSRIs, of Adderall and Ritalin and things like that, and everybody's taking more drugs. We're taking mood altering drugs consciously now.
But I do think, I mean, because this is a Nick Gillespie hosted podcast, we'll just go all in on generational caricatures. But like, you know, Prozac generation, Adderall generation. But this generation is anxiety, right? Like anxiety and this sort of PTSD cluster is that. That's
it's a good thing that Xanax is now off patent. So it's like $3 a month.
I guess so. That's good. The generic Xanax is going to keep the generation afloat.
And so for those of us who are like older millennials, right? The early 1980s people, the Xennials, as they call us. Like our thing
I thought
is
we're Xennials.
I thought it was pronounced Xennials.
But like then xylophone? What are we going to say about Gen the half X millennial, Xennials? Half generation
Zillennials?
Is like a kind of ironic anxiety. That's what we participate in.
Right. It was Daria and Six Sad World.
Right. I mean, that's but so like
but no, Daria,
that's the little Oregon Trail generation. That's our thing, is that we've got the ironic attitude of the Gen Xers and the anxiety of the millennials. Maybe not you. Maybe this is just me.
It's not me.
Maybe it's literally a
but
generation.
But since our generation is so
me.
Small, if you and I split, the whole concept falls apart.
I think there's a couple others.
OK, well, let's as an exit point, as I was going to say, an exit wound to this conversation. Peter, Black Panther. Good movie or goodest movie?
It's quite good. I really enjoyed it. I think it is one of the better Marvel films. However, one of the things that sort of stuck out to me is that it's very good as a Marvel film. It's maybe not the best, but it's in some ways quite limited by the Marvel formula. And so the director here is Ryan Coogler, who did Fruitvale Station and also Creed. And he's a really fantastic director. Just a kind of innovative, poetic. His images are just have incredible fluidity to them. And you see that some of the time here in Black Panther. But ultimately, it feels like a kind of episode of the Marvel TV show that Ryan Coogler came in and guest directed. It doesn't feel really like a deeply personal Ryan Coogler film in the way that I, and again, it's different. It's not just exactly this, the cookie cutter Marvel formula. It's an all black cast that really kind of focuses on, on the responsibilities of being a black nation and being black and powerful in a way that we just haven't seen in a Hollywood movie of this scale before. And so on the one hand, the Marvel imprint allows that to happen. You could not imagine $200 million plus being spent on a movie with a young black director, two young black stars, and a mostly black cast, unless it already had the kind of baked-in expectation of success that Marvel gives it.
Which it's...
On the other hand, Ryan Coogler doesn't really get to do the things that he's really, truly... He gets to kind of show off here and there, right? It felt a little bit like he was... a great guitarist in a cover band, kind of adding his own bits here and there, but not like his own, not like the stuff. That
I don't
really
think you're selling the movie, which I saw last night. So I'm going to weigh in. I don't think you're selling it to either of our co-podcasters right now.
But the face that I'm making is a response to the Suderman-esque metaphors, which are like. It's like inception of Suderman metaphors now. We're like all the way down. Sorry.
To be clear, I liked this movie
I was
a lot.
Actually kind of thinking like I was in a Christopher Nolan movie rather than a Ryan Coogler movie. But I want to point out that Michael B. Jordan, who is in both Creed and Fruitvale Station, earlier movies, he plays the kind of the orphaned Wakandan who is left in a slum in Oakland and grows up without a father, et cetera, and comes back to reclaim
and
the crown.
Also becomes highly trained
as
kind
a
of
killer.
Assassin by the American government, right?
And does his job very well. But what I liked about the movie and what I would recommend to you guys, and I realize we've lost, both Catherine and Robbie here, but what's great about it is it's one of those movies where the antagonist or the villain has a bunch of set speeches that are so much more compelling and convincing. Like his case for why he got screwed over and why he is right really kind of go unrebutted. And he's about how blacks have been treated poorly and that, in America he was treated poorly and in the world blacks were, and we're going to do it differently. And then of course he becomes a monster himself. But it's, I love those kinds of movies where the villain, it's kind of like in Last of the Mohicans when Uncas, you know, starts, you know, getting mad and saying like, you know what, like you guys, you've just fucked us over. Like, fuck you. And you're like, God, you know, he's right. And they don't bother, or excuse me, Magua, but they don't bother arguing with him. They just have to kill him.
So I obviously, I think we've even talked about this on the podcast before, the Loki speech about how humanity is born to kneel would maybe be in this, category, made to be ruled, of the sort of fundamentally unrefuted villain speech.
I think Captain America stands up and says something like, I knew a guy, right? Like something like he like makes a Hitler reference.
But meanwhile,
basically,
there's still a lot of kneeling. Yeah. I don't know. My question about this movie is how long is the like super extended chase sequence in the middle? Is it longer or shorter than the basic Marvel super extended
chase sequence? Oh, it's exactly as long as all of them are. This is a 2-hour and 15-minute movie.
But it seems shorter. Like I'm not a fan of that. And also like fight scenes just are awful at this point.
The way they shortened it is they attached the chase sequence to a big club fight, which is probably the best action sequence in the movie.
Club like
no,
so they go to
club.
a club, right? Like a bar kind of
like a discotheque, not like a fight with
well,
heavy
it's,
sticks.
There's a fight with heavy sticks
in the club.
Great.
There's kind of like a shillelagh type,
it's a pun fight.
An African shillelagh.
That
but no, but this is like a club casino.
Fine. Yeah. All I'm saying is it doesn't drag.
It's a really nicely paced movie. And yes, Michael B. Jordan's villain is arguably the best villain in the Marvel Universe. And the first villain, I think, who really gives viewers something to think about.
I was also rooting for, because he's an American, and he comes to an African thing. Like I instinctively was rooting for Michael B. Jordan because he was an American. One of the problems with these movies,
an unforeen Gillespie patriotism.
Oh no, no! I always want the American in any kind of movie or context to win. And like he talks like an American, and he talks in a kind of rap patois a little bit, but it's mostly it's good because all the Africans are very noble and you know kind of like wooden characters, but.
Well, maybe I'm just waiting to see it until all people of color have been given a chance. That? There was some ally to the community saying on Twitter that she was not good. When asking,
screenings are not for you.
When should I be able to see?
So
the
this
movie?
Is like the continuation of the Wonder Woman showings that were for ladies only.
Yeah, of course.
It opened in like 4,000 screens. Yeah. Ended up and like all of them sold out every show. Right. It is now the fifth highest opening weekend of all time, behind two Star Wars movies, Jurassic World and The Avengers. Yeah.
It also, by the way, I thought, and Peter, we'll end with this because I feel like this is becoming the chase scene that Catherine was warning us about.
I would watch the Reason staff chase scene all day long.
There was basically a chase sequence with Captain America on top of the Reason building.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
Is an interesting kind of metaphor, both for some of a kind of Black Lives Matter type of stuff coming through this, but then also as interesting, Wakanda, the kind of secret, you know, super high tech fantasy world that the Black Panther reigns over as a monarch. It's an autarky, like it is self-contained. It doesn't trade with the world. And one of the things that is interesting about it is that there's progress in that in a way that
it kind of reverses
an America Firster attitude as we see normally espoused in American political
discourse. Right, the end, and so this is a little bit spoilers. Yeah. I'm going to give people who are super spoiler averse, but the end of the movie, obviously the villain is sort of defeated in a moment of kind of epic poetry. But
spoiler alert, Marvel villain defeated? Yes. I mean,
Wakanda chooses...
He tastes the dismal dregs of defeat.
Wakanda chooses to open itself to the world and start helping other people. And like, I mean, again, you can't imagine a movie made by a white director that ends with a superhero opening a charter school, which is basically what happens here.
But it's also this, one of the things that's annoying is it's like it's Jeffrey Sachs' vision of helping the world because Wakanda is secretly super rich. And they're like, oh, we're going to give aid mostly to people instead of like, why can't we have a Marvel universe that ends where Captain America beats his stupid shield into
plowshare.
Yeah, well, but something better than that. We don't need a plowshare. We've got
beats it into an iPhone.
Yeah, something like that. Where it's like, you know what we're going to do?
So
we're going to trade
the Reason podcast in which Wakandans open charter schools and Captain America beats his shield into an iPhone. I think we've
reached a natural exit point, so we're going to stop here. This has been the Reason Podcast. We've been talking with Robbie Suave, Peter Sitterman, and Catherine Manga Ward. I'm Nick Gillespie, and I'm moderating, hopefully never again, or what do you call this? It's not moderating. What is it? It's hosting. It's
sure
adjudicating. I don't know. But when Matt Welch, if and when he comes back from the Soviet Union, he's gone back in time. I think he's floating in an iceberg somewhere under Iceland right now. He's getting special powers. But when he comes back, we'll do it. But in the meantime, please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while we're there. And you're there, too.